You're listening to the CLE Foodcast with Lisa Sands, the place for delicious conversation on local food and the people who grow, cook, and share it. Here's Lisa.
My guest today is Laura Gabbard, a documentary filmmaker appearing at the Cleveland International Film Festival for a screening of her film, Food and Country. The film was a collaboration with renowned food critic and writer Ruth Reichel, and it was made during the high point of the COVID-19 pandemic. Reichel interviewed hundreds of restaurant owners, farmers, suppliers, and community activists, and Gabbard and her team ventured across the country to capture footage of the forever changed landscape of American food production. If you missed the film in person, you can watch Food and Country and many other films that played during the 11-day festival through CIF 47 Streams, the online version of the live festival. Head to clevelandfilm.org to purchase the streaming package and watch many of the groundbreaking, thought-provoking independent films that screened at the 2023 festival. Did this week's springtime weather get you thinking about your garden? Me too. Although I don't really plant a huge garden, my summer herbs and veggies are mostly in patio pots. Regardless, you need to know about tomato monster heirlooms. Lee and Adam are starting thousands of healthy heirloom tomato and pepper plants right now, and you can buy them at a series of public events that actually support other local organizations. I'll be sharing my gardening successes with you on my social channels. Let's see how I do with the tomato and pepper varieties I got from Tomato Monster Heirlooms. Check them out right now at tomatomonsterheirlooms.com and order some, and they'll be ready to plant in your garden right around Mother's Day. That's tomatomonsterheirlooms.com. You might know Laura Gabbard from another one of her documentaries called City of Gold, but in this interview, we're talking to her about food and country, and specifically several people in the documentary, including Ohio farmers Lee and Bob Jones of the Chef's Garden in Milan, Ohio. Whether you watch the film or not, trust me, you'll get something out of this conversation. Laura, it's so great to welcome you to Cleveland and Playhouse Square and to sit with you here at the Cleveland International Film Festival. Welcome.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here.
You are here because one of your films is screening and it is called Food and Country. It is just an exceptional film. It speaks to many of us here, many of my listeners of the CLE Foodcast who care very much about where their food comes from, who is making it, how that food is raised. Not only is it screening at the festival, but it is part of the CIF Streams program, which starts April 2nd and runs a full week after. So if you couldn't come to see the film, people can watch it at home.
That's right. I know. I'm thrilled about that.
That's excellent. Well, so people who saw it live in beautiful Playhouse Square on a large screen were really treated to something special because the visuals are just astounding. I can only imagine what that was like to be part of that, to be there shooting those. But really, if you look beyond that, it's a very close examination of the state of our food system and the issues as told through a series of individuals that you spent a lot of time with. So I'd love to know how the project got started.
So early days of the pandemic in March 2020, I had made a film previously about Jonathan Gold, the Los Angeles Times food writer, mm-hmm. who passed away in 2018, sadly. And so I'd gotten to know a lot of restaurant owners in Los Angeles by making that film. So I was immediately worried about the hospitality business, about all these independent small restaurants and how they were going to make it. So I was talking to a lot of people about maybe making a short film about that or covering it somehow. And Ruth Reichel, who I had met while making City of Gold, she's mm-hmm. in a scene in City of Gold, heard that I was thinking about working on something. And so she reached out to me and she said, you know, this is going to affect much more than restaurants. You know, she grasped right away, early days, that this was going to have this huge ripple effect, you know, for farmers and ranchers and fishermen and suppliers, purveyors mm-hmm. everywhere. And she said, maybe we should work on something together. And, you know, we just, you know, remember those early days of COVID, we didn't really know how long it was going to last or what was going to happen. And so we're like, yeah, let's start talking about it. And we decided that the best way to do it would be to have Ruth reach out on Zoom, recorded Zoom calls with just the people she knew at first. Mm-hmm. So she called her old friends like Alice Waters mm-hmm. and other restaurant owners like Marcus Samuelson. And then she quickly sort of started moving into, okay, who supplies these people? Okay, Lee and Bob Jones of Chef's Garden, who you all know well. Mm-hmm. and just really started talking, like, what is it like right now? What are you doing? How are you coping? How are you adapting? How are you feeling? And she really did these calls on a very regular basis. And, you know, I think the film has about maybe 10 main characters and a few extra policy people. But during COVID, she spoke to over 100 people.
Wow.
And some of them on a regular basis, because we didn't know who would end up in the film or not.
Mm-hmm.
And we also, at that point, didn't know we were going to use the Zoom calls in the film. We thought it was a little, you know, research and development exercise, basically, mm-hmm. and that we would watch the Zoom calls and then go out into the field and shoot. But as COVID went on and on and on, and we weren't quite sure about how safe it was, when we really didn't know how to protect ourselves, we kept recording the calls, and we hired remote shooters in some of these locations in the early days. And mm-hmm. then once it was safer...
Mm-hmm.
We did go out and shoot in the field with kind of the characters, the subjects that we felt just would resonate the most with people. Mm-hmm. You know, it is a bit of a casting job when you're making a documentary,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
We're trying to find a diverse group of people, people who represented different parts of our country.
Mm-hmm.
You did an amazing job with that. I mean, it's really coast to coast and everything in between what people would think of or would have called the flyover states,
yep.
all of that. So interesting to me is that, again, I was wondering if it was Zoom that she was using, because like we all just at some point, that's how we were communicating.
Yeah.
So it was almost like a casting call, right? Like she's talking to all these people. She wanted to connect personally. And then you could look at that and say, oh, let's dig a little deeper into this particular story.
Correct. And we were looking for people who were really trying to adapt and do things differently. We were also looking for people who, you know, we have everyone from a Lee and Bob Jones who have, you know, have had a regenerative farm for decades.
Mm-hmm.
Right, to Angela and Carrie Knuth in Mead, Nebraska, who have a very conventional farm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's how they have farmed.
Mm-hmm.
And at the beginning of COVID, Angela Knuth was thinking, I think we should try to transition some of our crops to organic. So it was interesting to see people at different stages
mm-hmm.
of, for example, turning to organic or regenerative.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the stories that I loved, I am a meat eater. I'm an omnivore, mm-hmm. But a picky one. I like to really know where my food comes from. And we're lucky here because we have farm stores, we have farmers markets, and we have the West Side Market, where I can, for the most part, trace a lot of my meat, right? My meat and poultry. Was Will Harris's story at White Oak. Here's this, like, for lack of a better description, a typical farm guy really talking about how his father, I think he's fourth generation,
mm-hmm.
his father wanted to move more into conventional. He mm-hmm. wanted to move more into an industrialized opportunity, and something didn't sit right with him. And I think that was just a really great telling of how in his bones he knew that that was the wrong direction for his farm. And boy, that's some of the most beautiful animal footage in the whole film.
I know. If you ever get the chance to go to White Oak Pastures, they have these cabins you can rent and you can go there and visit. And it's really spectacular. I mean, when he says, I don't think of my farm as like a farm, I think of it as an organism. That's what it feels like there.
Yes.
It's really beautiful. Like most farmers, you know, in those years, Will's father industrialized his farm. I mean, mm-hmm. that's what you had to do to really survive. And they were pushing you to do that. I mean, the government was pushing people to do that. So, and I think for Will, for him, the first thing, and he talks about it in the film, is the first thing was the stewardship of the animals. That's the mm-hmm. part that didn't feel right to him. He knew that he wanted his animals to follow their natural instincts,
mm-hmm.
right? And he had a gut feeling that was going to be better for his soil
mm-hmm.
and better for the animals
yes.
and better for us when we eat the animals.
Well, he proved in that experiment that everything is connected. His soil got better because the animals were doing what they were supposed to do. And he's a farmer, but he talks like a scientist,
yeah.
which I thought was so interesting.
Yeah.
And interestingly enough, let's talk about Farmer Jones Farm for a bit, because again, I have a lot of familiarity with them. Their research, their R&D facility is amazing. I've had the pleasure to tour it. A lot of people do not get to see that, but they're thinking so forward.
Mm-hmm.
They're not thinking about now and this year's crop or next year's crop. They're thinking mm-hmm. about the future.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I think it was Bob in the interview, he said, are we willing to pay more for quality food that is grown right and socially responsible? Which really, at the end of the day, is the crux, or I should say a major theme throughout mm-hmm. this whole documentary, is people that used the pandemic,
mm-hmm.
the pivots, the changes, the time to think, to ask themselves really hard questions about what they're doing here. But equally, you could see, and you told many stories of people in survival mode. Mm-hmm. Those restaurants, going back, I have to say, I just got a little shiver just now, looking at some of the images of empty restaurants, hearing restaurateurs talk about, or some of the farmers that employ lots and lots of people, about what it was like to stand in front of their team and say, we just don't know how long this is going to go. We don't know how we're going to pay you. We don't know how we're going to change this model fast enough. But people just dove in and did it. Is there a story from the restaurant community that you remember in particular?
I mean, I think the two restaurants we really focus on, we do hit on some other chefs and restaurants as well, but are Min Phan from Los Angeles and then Rima Seal from Oakland, the Bay Area, because they both are, you know, they're well-regarded chefs and they have little businesses, but they're little businesses. You know, they're surviving month to month. And they're not owned by bigger corporations, right? Mm-hmm. So they both, I thought what was interesting about them is they both pivoted in sort of different ways, pretty dramatically different ways. Mm-hmm. In the early days, they both did the same thing. Mm-hmm. They just, I mean, there was money to tap into, right, that the government was giving some restaurants, and there were organizations they could tap into, like Jose Andreas's organization that was giving a lot of money to restaurants to stay alive. And to feed people, right? Mm-hmm. So therefore, these restaurant owners could keep their employees on. But that money only lasted so long, and then people shifted to little, you know, shops and trying to keep their purveyors, their farmers alive. You know, Min Phan turned her restaurant into a little farm shop, right? Mm-hmm. So she could keep buying the produce that she would have used to make meals, and then she was just selling the produce to people. Mm-hmm. So, you know, people pivoted and adapted in different ways. Rima Seal up in Oakland, she really, for her, she'd always been an activist, always interested in social justice issues. She was a labor organizer before she became a chef. She thought, this is my moment to turn my business into a collective and have it be an employee-owned business.
Yes, I remember that story.
Which is a pretty radical thing to do in the middle of a pandemic. Equally as radical, Min Phan said, I think I'm going to open up a fine dining restaurant. You know, because she realized she couldn't, the economics of her business didn't work. She had to charge more for food so she could pay her employees more. Mm-hmm. It was also something she'd wanted to do, but they both looked at this problem in different ways. But I think first and foremost, they wanted to take care of their workers, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was very apparent. I mean, I have countless stories from here. I launched this about 2 years ago, the podcast, and the really rough part of COVID was over. We were definitely on the outset, right? And patio dining was back and all of those things. But talking to Chef Doug Katz or Ben Biebenroth, who also owns a farm in the Cuyahoga Valley National Park, hearing them describe just the stress, the number crunching, the just the back end of restaurants that we just didn't really think about as consumers. And they both, you know, used it as a reset, right? Mm-hmm. To recommit to, okay, if I have to change what I'm serving so that I can be more efficient, so that people can be home with their families. And just all of those issues were coming out.
Right.
I know in this documentary, there's just, I just loved it. I mean, like I was saying to you just before we signed on here that every story can be its own documentary because there's not one story in this documentary that is more important than the others. They all show a tremendous impact to someone's livelihood, their belief system, you know, so it was really, really deep. And I think that Ruth's role in those Zoom calls, which at first you're like, oh, she is on Zoom. You know, you're looking at that. It's such a, it was very personal. Those interviews almost, I wonder if she almost got more personal through that mechanism, right? Than sitting down across from somebody in an interview format where people get a little bit more nervous, right? I think people were craving connection. They wanted to talk with people. She did a wonderful job luring that out of people.
Yeah, it was one of the wonderful, wonderful accidents of making a film in COVID, right? So as I said, we started out doing the Zoom calls, recorded Zoom calls for research and development. And as we started watching them, I just thought, wow, these are really intimate people. They knew they were being recorded, but they would kind of forget because liberated from that traditional documentary, as you said, sort of situation where you throw up a light and you set up a chair and the camera's there and there's everyone watching this person and they feel like they have to speak in a certain way. People just had conversations. I mean, and what when we were editing the film, my editor and I would just say, it's like, we're making kind of a film of conversations, basically, mm-hmm. you know, which was kind of fun. And then you have that immediacy of Zoom where, you know, typically with a documentary, our budgets are really always, they're always low. You can't go back and film with people multiple times, usually, if they're all over the country. And we had multiple characters all over the country. Mm-hmm. But with Zoom, they could just set up a call. And so something could dramatically have changed in 2 weeks and we would have it again, but in the moment, mm-hmm. right? So they could talk about what they were experiencing in the moment and not, well, when that happened 6 months ago, I felt this, this, and this, mm-hmm. or we did this, this, and this. You know, it was that spontaneity and immediacy that the Zoom calls gave us.
And then what was so wonderful and genius, I'm sure when you realized that you could use the Zoom footage to piece the film together, to hear the talking and then see the visuals that they were just explaining, to go to the place where they were. I thought that was just really great. I think you were able to get to some of those locations yourself as the filmmaker.
Yeah.
Was there one or two that seemed especially impactful to you, or a place that you visited and you went, wow, I've never seen something like this before?
I mean, there's many, so yeah. I don't even know how to pick one. But I think that, you know, I think both Chef's Garden, Bob and Lee Jones, and Will Harris and his daughter, Jenny and Jody Harris, down at White Oak Pastures in Bluffton, Georgia, those two places were really... I grew up outside of Minneapolis, so I'm not unfamiliar with farming, mm-hmm. but I haven't spent a lot of time on farms. And just seeing these people farming so thoughtfully and intelligently and with so much passion, mm-hmm. and then also just the beauty of it, you know, and mm-hmm. seeing them really, really care about the people who work for them or the animals that they're raising, they're growing, you know, and hearing their incredible, you know, generations long story of their farm with all the drama, you know, I mean, the Joneses lost their farm in the early 80s mm-hmm. during the farm crisis, or Will Harris, you know, completely transformed his farm in the 90s. His father had completely industrialized it and he very slowly started turning it into a regenerative farm, mostly by instinct. Mm-hmm. He wasn't really following a manual. Mm-hmm. It just didn't feel right to him.
Yeah, he was watching the animals do their natural thing, and he knew that's how he wanted them to live.
Yep.
And again, I think we have a community here in Cleveland of people, you know, we have some great places like Ohio City Provisions, Yellow House Cheese, again, the farmers markets that we have. There are people doing that work, and there's something to be said for meeting the person. I mean, I'm watching along now. It's lambing season. I guess it's lambing season everywhere, but here there's like three or four farms that I follow on Instagram, and I cannot wait to see the baby lambs. Yes, at some point those lambs are going to be on someone's plate, and that is the goal. That's how that farm makes their money. That's their livelihood. But the care and concern and just, you can't raise sheep and deliver lambs yourself and help a sheep deliver a lamb. It's very visual, let me tell you. I mean, I love when that stuff is shared because I think we need to be more connected
yeah.
to where that stuff happens. I like to go down there and stand in the middle of a field of turkeys mm-hmm. and think, yes, I am going to be enjoying one of these turkeys at some point, but boy, are these turkeys having a good time.
Yeah.
You know,
and they're happy and healthy animals. So,
And farmers really, someone said it in the film, farmers care more about animals, certain kinds of farmers, mm-hmm. the farmers that see their own animals every day, they care more about their animals. They know more, they're so intimate with their animals than anybody would ever imagine. And I don't know. And the end result is the end result. But again, we've been doing that for years and years, right?
Yep. I mean, one of the memories I have that actually isn't in the film is of Steve Stratford, our Kansas rancher, who's more of a conventional rancher, but he cares deeply about his animals and the mm-hmm. issues around ranching and all the antitrust issues that people are talking about these days. But at one point, we were supposed to go film with him, and we had to cancel. And he said, "It's calf-killing weather." He's like, "I'm out in my truck trying to save calves."
Oh.
And he'd been like driving around for 2 days, just trying to save all the baby calves. It's like we don't think about this, and we think about buying meat, right?
Right. Yeah.
How stark that is, and how upset he was. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, he's upset because, of course, it's his business, it's his livelihood, but they also care.
Oh, very much so.
Right?
Let's switch gears for a minute and talk about some of the urban environments that you were in. You also have some people in your film that are more well-known to people. Mm-hmm. Grant Achatz mm-hmm. of pronounce it?
Alinea.
I'm going to give up. I have to give up, Laura. I just can't do it.
Alinea in Chicago.
In Chicago. Yep. And Marcus Samuelson in, I think his restaurants are in New York and the Bronx.
Yeah, in Harlem.
In Harlem.
Yep.
To see them appear as well. Marcus, I think, connected, it looked like he connected Ruth to that outstanding woman.
Karen Washington.
Karen Washington running those community gardens. Yep. Talk about Karen Washington.
So, I mean, that was the other fun thing I'll just say really quickly before I get into wonderful Karen Washington is that, you know, a lot of times some of the subjects connected us to other subjects. So Grant Ashatz and Nick Kokonis of Alinea connected us to Will Harris, right?
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So, and we show some of those connections as one of the characters is saying, oh, you should talk to this person. Actually, this would be a good person. But yes, Marcus really wanted Ruth to talk to Karen because Ruth had been doing a lot of reading and research around black farms in America and the history of black farms. And so she was sort of, you know, giving Marcus some statistics. And he said, oh, well, you should talk to Karen. You know, she's a farmer. So not only does she have her own farm in upstate New York, she also has, she runs Rise and Root Farms. That's in upstate New York. And then she has an urban farm in South Bronx. Plus, she was responsible for getting the South Bronx farmers market going.
Mm.
Right. So to provide, you know, fresh, healthy food to that community. And she's also an activist. You know, she speaks all over the world. And, you know, she is really out there trying to help communities grow their own food, start farms, training farmers. She's an educator, and she's really a force.
Mm, that's exciting. I think we have the little nuggets of a movement here happening with black farmers and people in the urban corridor, the urban sector of Cleveland, particularly East Cleveland, that there's just a lot of vacant property. It's just sitting there. In some cases, it just needs a good cleanup, but things can be grown on it. And there are some emerging leaders that are making sure some of that happens. So I think we're going to see a lot of that here coming
up. That's
great.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah. Ismail Samad, he was, I can't remember the episode, but he was just talking to him. I mean, our episode ran an hour. And I mean, I just found myself thinking like, oh my gosh, this guy is going to really change things. Mm. And he's also, and here's a guy who grew up in East Cleveland, went away, lived as a chef in Putney, Vermont, Little Putney, Vermont. He worked on Martha's Vineyard. He's involved in a couple of urban markets, Nubian markets in Boston. Mm. But he came home to live, I think, next door to his parents. He wanted his two daughters to have a very different life. But he's been granted a lot of access to money, to people that can make decisions. And he is just, he's taking no prisoners. I mean, he's just, anybody that can help him, he's getting that help. So, but it's an uphill battle to hear him talk about it. It's just an uphill battle.
I want to listen to that episode. I will.
Thank you. I will appreciate it. I'll make sure I send that to
you. Okay, please do.
So you had a lot of material to cull through by the end. So what were the pillars that you stayed true to, like the takeaways that you wanted people to have when they watched Food and Country?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think it's something, I will start by saying, you know, it was a challenge editing this film because we had so many compelling characters and characters that didn't even make it into the film or characters we could have expanded upon, but a film is a film and it can only be so long if you really want to get people to stay seated. And I think for us, what we knew, we didn't want to make a COVID film, right? I mean, so the way I talk about it is COVID prompts the film. It's sort of the inciting event of the film, but the film really becomes sort of a look at the people behind our food, who grows our food, who makes our food, you know, who produces our food.
Mm-hmm.
And in getting to have a window into their lives during a crisis period, but then you learn history from them. You learn about, you know, their father or their mother, and you learn about their practices. So you kind of leave the COVID conflict behind and you start to care about the people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I really think that's the power of storytelling and that's the power of changing minds is when you get to know people who are different than you, who come from a different place in the country, who spend their days differently, you start to see, oh, we have all these things in common,
mm-hmm.
basically. You can relate to them. And so then you begin to care more about what they're doing, and then you therefore care more about the food you're buying,
mm-hmm.
right? You're curious about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we wanted to spark people's curiosity about their own choices as consumers, for one. We wanted them to think about the importance of buying locally and regionally and supporting those regional hubs
mm-hmm.
so those farmers can thrive.
Mm-hmm.
I think we wanted people to really think about the labor and economic issues around food.
Right.
You know, and so giving them a little bit of a history lesson in terms of, you know, how our food production changed after World War II.
Where labor comes from.
Where labor comes from is a theme. Is a theme in the film. You know, so it's a dense film. There's a lot of information in it, so sometimes it's hard just to say one thing. But I mean, I do think that was really our goal, and then how we actually casted the characters. Like, these people are such amazing spokespeople for rural America and agriculture, at least for the farming piece of it, and then kind of for our restaurants, you know, just having people think a little bit more when they go into a restaurant, like, how is this business actually working, and how are these people getting paid, and how much is the dishwasher getting paid, you know?
Or why does my dinner that cost, you know, $20 2 years ago cost $27?
Correct.
I mean, there's just,
correct,
those are not easy decisions.
Yep.
And
yep,
I think we're being forced to ask that. You know, one of the other themes that came up, I loved it. It was kind of buried in the middle, but it's been a goal of mine with this podcast is, you know, food is fun. In the last 20 years, the Food Network being very much a major catalyst of it is food is, right? We eat it because we need to eat it, but we've hobbyfied it over the years.
Yeah.
We've glamorized it. And something that I really wanted to do through this forum, through this channel, is hear people talk about it in their own words, because there was nothing really like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, the best kind of storytelling is when people are telling you in their own words what they're thinking, what they're experiencing. And I just think it hits differently. It lands differently.
The other thing that I think that I think for us in making the film, you know, Ruth, who's a producer and very much in the film, and then myself as the director and my other producers, we one of the things we sort of not stumbled upon, but became very aware of as we were editing the film, is that we were sort of excited that maybe we're making a bipartisan documentary. Because so many documentaries preach to the choir. So it's an issue that if you're on the left, you care about. And so you want to see it. But it's hard to get people who are on the other side of the aisle to watch that film. And I think that what we discovered in making the film is, you know, no matter if you're in a red state or a blue state, food connects all of us. And if you talk to these different people, and we have in the film, there are characters on both sides of the aisle too. Mm-hmm. If you strip away the politics, they actually agree if it has to do with how you grow food.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought that's so, there's such an opportunity there.
Mm-hmm.
So
anything that can be a catalyst or a mechanism to bring people together to realize common ground is really important. I'm not really seeing a lot of that.
Yeah,
right,
exactly.
Now.
Yeah.
So I love that you did that. Something I wanted to add also is buried in the middle of the film is Ruth talking about, just very briefly about the career that she had, the fact that she was a food critic on both, you know, in the two of the best food cities in the world. And then she edited, or oversaw Gourmet Magazine. I mean, this was her being very stripped down, very pared down. It's like she had this career that gave her a lot of access, and she certainly had the opportunity to learn a lot and meet a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, I think she also realized, it's sort of what you were just saying, like, what's really important.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the basics.
Yep.
You know?
Yep. Yeah. And I think Ruth is the first to admit that she knows more about food and even agriculture than most people, but she learned a lot about our agricultural system this year too, you know, just in getting to know people. You know, as simple as that.
Yeah.
So, you know, she had actually been to Chef's Garden before and visited them years ago because she admired what they were doing. But she got to know so many other people that she would not have otherwise. And I think that she's so good at drawing people out and being kind of a confidant, but also a really good reporter at the same time.
Yes.
You know, and so we're so lucky. I mean, I'm so lucky that I was able to collaborate with her on this, you know.
And I also think, even though you intentionally did not want this to be a COVID film, I think it's important at this moment in time to remember we've all moved on, right? We're all doing life basically like we used to.
Mm-hmm.
Not everyone, but a lot of us
are.
A
lot of us, yeah.
I think it's, I found it jarring actually to see the mask wearing, the separation of, you know, I saw some people getting together and they're keeping the distance and all of that. And again, the empty restaurants and things. I forgot about it. And I'm not sure how I feel about that, that I've moved on already. Like that's our, I guess, a natural human coping mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
So I like the fact that this film will forever chronicle that period of time for all of us, but particularly the food industry, because those individuals making food on that small scale became the lifeline in a lot of cases when the major grocery stores and the chains didn't have anything. You just saw on the national news, everything was empty. You know, our people here were saying, hey, we've got it. We're working directly with a supplier an hour away and we've got beef. We've got this, we've got that. So I think a lot of people may have gone back to their old habits, but I also think a lot of people didn't. So I think showing those COVID times, the pandemic, I think it was really important that you did that, that you didn't leave it totally behind.
You know, I thank you for saying that. I mean, I think that we couldn't not include it because it really was part of the story. And I think that you're right. And, you know, Ruth actually says that the moment she realized that this was such a big deal was the day she walked into a grocery store and the shelves were empty. Mm-hmm. And she said, Americans are not used to not, you know, to not seeing like abundant, perfect food everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, where that's the case in a lot of countries.
No, that happened in 1940 and not since then. And we don't remember it. None of us know it. My generation does not know what that was
that's
like.
Correct. That's correct.
But that was weird. And not getting toilet paper was also just very terrible.
Yeah, it's just everything was, And, it, you know, it stopped us in our tracks. Mm-hmm. And I think that you're right. I think that is one of the silver linings is that people started to think more carefully about where their food comes from and hopefully, you know, look to sort of regional and local sources.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was really touched by the stories in the film. They remind me of people that I personally have connected with in the last couple of years, farmers, restaurateurs, small makers that, you know, small businesses were born out of this necessity. And I've been really privileged to tell a lot of those stories here. There was something, I wrote this down word for word that Ruth said in the film. And it's related to, again, the inclusion of the Zoom interviews. She said she had never connected so personally to people she was interviewing. The isolation of COVID did something really unexpected. It sparked deeper relationships and deeper understanding. The people I met this year give me hope. They are independent of the industrialized model. Their collective vision may hold the key to our well-being. How we grow and make our food tells us who we are as a nation, and more importantly, how we are as human beings. I love that.
Yeah. Yeah.
How are you changed from this film?
I think, I mean, in many of the ways I want audiences to be affected. I mean, I think I because I've made documentaries about food, you know, I do support local farms around me in Los Angeles and all of that. But, you know, I think much more about my meat and where I get my meat now. That's something I'm more thoughtful about. I think I understand how hard it is to be a restaurant owner and that if you're not 100% passionate about it, you probably shouldn't do it. because it's a hard...
It doesn't look very fun.
Yeah, it's hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
I mean, there are fun parts, of course, right? The parts that we think of. But there's so much more.
There's so much more. And I think, you know, I think it's... I can't remember what the statistics are exactly, but I think it was like 50 years ago, like most of us knew a farmer or had a relative that was a farmer or, you know, a cousin or someone. And now almost no one knows a farmer.
Mm-hmm.
And we're so disconnected from the food we eat. And the thing is that it's not just about, you know, supporting those businesses. It's about the environment, you know. It's about national security, actually. Mm-hmm. I mean, if our country doesn't control the food we eat, we're in big trouble. And increasingly, we don't.
Right.
So
it's happening before our eyes.
So I think that it just touches so many different issues. Food is one of these things that just... It hits on everything. Mm-hmm. Like, you name it. You name an issue in this country, and it hits on it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you hit on those in this film. So Food and Country screened at the Cleveland International Film Festival this year, but it will also be part of the film festival's streaming program, SIFF 47 Streams, which runs for a whole week. This podcast should hit right in the middle of that. But I know eventually you're hoping for some wider distribution for the film. I wish you a lot of luck on that, because... this is a film that everyone who cares about food should watch. And if you don't really know much about food, you should watch it also, because it's going to teach you something. I just don't know how you'd watch it and not sit with yourself and think about the choices that you make, whether you're going to go to the big box store or whether you're going to say, you know what, I'm going to adopt a couple of local farmers because I believe in what they're doing. And I believe that their product is superior to what I can get anywhere else. And I do think, again, the people that listen to this podcast do that. It's really getting the word out to the masses.
To the masses.
I think you've done that. Laura, thank you so much for being on the CLE Foodcast, and I hope you enjoy your very brief visit to Cleveland, and you must come back and see some of these places.
Thank you. I would really love to. Thanks so much for having me on, Lisa.
Coming up on the CLE Foodcast, Sam Pellerito of Sinsoy, a Cincinnati-based maker of soy sauce and other fermented products, Chef Alejandro Nahar of The Blue Door, and a recent Hell's Kitchen finalist, and Aaron Huber Rosen, founder of Drink Local, Drink Tap. And I'm thrilled to partner with City Fresh, a farm box program supporting Ohio farmers working to increase food access to communities across Northeast Ohio. Thanks so much to Chef Douglas Katz and the Katz Group of Restaurants for being a sponsor of the CLE Foodcast. Make sure you check out Doug's restaurants when you can and tell him you heard about him on the CLE Foodcast. Until next time, stay hungry, be kind, and always, always set a bigger table.